Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We are here tonight with filmmaker, documentarian, Ramsey Dennison. How are you, Ramsey?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
Dude, you did an amazing new movie, but before we start talking about that, I want to ask you, where are you from originally?
Well, I grew up in Florida, Central Florida, and I've been in LA for about 15 years now.
Okay, so you're an Angeleno now, man.
Yeah, I've been one for a while, you know.
What city in Florida?
Small little place that no one's ever really heard of called Satellite Beach.
Oh, okay, Satellite Beach.
One of those little beach towns, sleepy beach towns, one of many in Florida, about an hour from Orlando, Central Florida.
Oh, it's awesome, man. I've been all over Florida, but I've not been to your town, so I'll have to venture. Yeah. So you came here 15 years ago, and did you study film anywhere? Or what made you want to become a filmmaker?
Yeah, I came out in 04, you know, and I started at working, you know, as a tape operator. And then, you know, and then after that, I became an assistant editor. And then I started off editing behind-the-scenes documentaries. Remember when you used to rent DVDs and there were those, like, awesome little behind-the-scenes documentaries?
Totally.
So I did those for, like, some pretty cool movies, like The Hills Have Eyes.
Good movie, man.
Yeah. So that was great. And then of course DVDs basically died in about 2008. So then I moved into television after that and started working as a television editor. So I've been a television, you know, I'm in the union. I've worked on shows like Naked and Afraid.
I was about to say, I'm a huge fan of that show just because it's like one of the shows we all watch at home all the time. And
right.
Man, that has to be, it's tricky editing. I have to ask you, there has to be like stock footage of like snakes and like animals that you have to like put in because like sometimes the editing is so good. I'm like, the chances of that snake being there in that lake or that river at that moment, it's just crazy.
I am going to say nothing.
You're sworn to secrecy. That's awesome. Well, good work on that show, man. The editing is actually very, very, very great. It really is well done. So you got into editing, and then what made you want to become a director and in specifically documentaries?
Well, you know, I mean, when I came out here and I started working in, like, doing behind-the-scenes documentaries, I just realized that, personally, I just find documentaries a lot more interesting and fun, especially the process of making them. You know, narrative films are not nearly as fun to do. You know, they require large crews. And basically the process of making a documentary is kind of it's a discovery, basically. Whereas, you know, if somebody's making a narrative film, it's all just like, it's, you know, you're like executing a plan and there's not as much kind of spontaneity. And so, I mean, I think what I love about making documentaries is just sitting in a room with experts, absolute experts in their field, and just like listening to them and learning about their, so I just enjoy the process of it a lot more. You know, I did do like narrative films before I moved out here and stuff. And I think it's just not a lot of fun to like, you know, like making films with crews and with large crews and, you know, and actors and all that stuff. I mean, that's great that people enjoy doing that, but it's just not my thing. I find it a little bit, you know, you just have far more freedom in documentaries. It just suits my personality better.
It's actually one of my favorite mediums, man. It's actually That's my bulldog saying hello.
Hey, bulldog, how's it going? What's your bulldog's name?
His name is Otis. He's making a little. He's making a cameo. Documentaries are my favorite genre of film, or one of them, and I'm always curious because it's kind of like, you know, these filmmakers are doing this amazing term paper because it's a research project. It's like, and it's amazing because sometimes a lot of filmmakers, they start out doing these documentaries and they don't know the subject matter or too much into it. And they start, I find like the best documentaries are the ones where, you know, the filmmakers start to submerge themselves into the subject as we're watching the movie. So you just see this like level of discovery and, you know, exploring the subject.
Yeah. A movie like Icarus, for example, where that guy, you know, which is an excellent movie about like him learning about like the Russian doping scandal. And you're just kind of like seeing him learn about it. And it's just, no, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, and yeah, they are like term papers. That's what documentaries are, really a process of discovery and learning. So, I mean, that's why I enjoy them too. Like, you know, I think it's a certain type of personality. I mean, I think the kind of people who love like reading and learning are the kind of people who like making documentaries a lot, I think.
Yeah, I especially love it because it's like for 2 hours or an hour and a half or whatever the time is, you learn about something that you may not know about. You know, it could be about ancient cave drawings, or, you know, I've seen some quirky ones at Sundance too, where it's just like, this is crazy, and I can't believe it's taking these turns, you know, in the way that it is. So who are some of your favorite documentarians, by the way?
I really like, you know, I like a lot of Michael Moore's early work. I like his sense of humor. And, you know, I would say I was influenced by his early documentaries. I like the Berlingers' work. You know, they're the ones who did, like, Paradise Lost. And many other good films. And let's see. Those are my top couple. Let's see. Who else?
Did you see Fahrenheit 11/9?
I haven't seen that one yet.
And it's a Michael Moore movie. And, you know, it's a really fantastic documentary. And not a lot of people gave it love. I don't know if it was marketed enough, but it was basically all about how Trump got elected and then all the things around, like, you know, what was happening in the U.S. from Flint, Michigan to, I mean, it's really eye-opening. So if you're a fan of Michael Moore, you should definitely check it out.
I will check it out. I mean, it's pretty incredible what Michael Moore did with the genre. I mean, you know, I remember him saying that, you know, for a long time, like, documentaries were these kind of like stuffy affairs that you would see on PBS, like just very formal and stiff. And Michael Moore really kind of like shook it up, and you know, he made them funny. He made movies like a 14-year-old in Ohio could watch and laugh at. Which I just think I mean, and that's why I admire him so much. He's the guy who busted through that genre and made it accessible. You know, documentaries were not on the map 40, 50 years ago, you know, like they are now. And I think he was a big part of like putting them on the map. Right.
He did Roger.
You know, he made them entertaining.
He made
Roger. Me. Awesome. Yeah.
And you know,
yeah, but Roger is awesome. Like, the comedy in that film is fantastic.
But when I saw Bowling for Columbine,
and there's just a social commentary.
When I saw Bowling for Columbine, I was like, man, this guy is a serious, serious filmmaker, and it just set a different precedent than most docs that I've seen. So, like you said, I love that he's an
influence.
We're going to get along great, man.
Yeah.
Well, definitely check that one out. That's some homework for you. So before we go into your movie that you're about to release, let's talk about What Happens in Vegas. Tell me how that first came about when that was one of your earlier works, right?
Yeah. So Money Machine, my film that's coming out on July 3rd, here's my second film about Vegas, documentary about Vegas. But my first documentary was called What Happened in Vegas. That was released in 2017. And that was, you know, about corruption in the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. And that movie had a really interesting beginning. Basically, in August of 2013, I happened to be walking in Vegas with a friend of mine. We're in a parking lot. And just out of the blue, we saw like four LVMPD officers. They had this guy in custody, and he was bent over the front of the police car, and they, you know, he wasn't going anywhere doing anything. But these officers were just like tugging on his cuffs, cutting off his circulation, and telling him, you know, does your mama know she raised an F up? Does she know that, son? This guy was just screaming his head off because they were abusing him. You know, and I'm not sure what this guy did to get arrested. I'm sure he deserved to get arrested, but I didn't think he deserved to be tortured. And it was like these officers were not really, they were just basically just four people just sitting there torturing this guy and laughing at him. And so I was with my friend at the time. And oddly enough, my friend had actually been a videographer for the Las Vegas SWAT team for many years. He's a guy I worked with in television. That's how I knew him. And he's looking at me like, I've never seen anything like this. This is crazy. And so actually what happened was I called 911 and said, you guys got to get a sergeant and a lieutenant down here because you got these four officers abusing this guy. And it's really terrifying. And so they asked me, you know, what kind of shirt I was wearing, what kind of pants I was, you know, I said white shirt, khaki pants. And then, you know, as soon as I hung up, and I guess that information got to back to the officers, because next thing you know, there's this officer who comes up to me and says, what are you doing? And I said, well, I've been watching what you're doing. There's nothing right about it. So I called 911 and told him about it. And he says, well, you better get the hell out of here or I'm going to have you arrested. And as I was walking away, I said, arrested for what? Next thing you know, I got two LVMPD officers on top of them. One of them slams a boot on my head. And they just, they put me on my stomach so I couldn't even breathe. And all this, and they're just like going, just yelling at me, you know, where are you from? I'm like, California. They're like, why don't you stay there? And I mean, they just screwed me up pretty good. And basically what happened was the guy lost his temper. So he now had to fabricate a series of false incidents to like justify losing his temper because he's now, you know, abused this citizen. And so, and his supervisor was on the way because of the call I'd placed and stuff. So this officer, Mark Bellinger and Kyle Frett, like the guy who helped cover for him, they concocted this just crap, just lies. And, you know, and I had a, you know, there's like people witnessing this and stuff, but they were going to teach me a lesson, I guess, give me some street justice. And so they just flat out lied and gave me these absurd charges. And then, of course, the charges were not, the charges were like dropped. But they, you know, like after I'd sat in Clark County for 3 days. So they did that so they could hold me and teach me a lesson. And then, you know, when I got out, I was just kind of like, you know, I was like, gosh, what an incredibly corrupt police department, you know, because I started trying to get a copy of the video. This happened in a parking lot, cameras pointed right at it. And all of a sudden, like they claimed the video cameras weren't on and just all this suspicious crap. And so that was really where my first film, What Happened in Vegas, started out. It started out with that incident and then it real quickly peels off. So only the first couple of minutes are, you know, it starts with that 911 call that I made. And then it goes into these other cases of police brutality and corruption in the LVMPD where video has conveniently gone missing and people who were killed who didn't need to be killed. And so yeah, that was What Happened in Vegas. And that film's actually had quite a life, you know, and especially now with what's going on in America. Yeah. A lot of people are watching that movie still, and you know, it's still on the iTunes charts. It went to number one on the iTunes documentary charts in June 2018, and now I think it's in the top 100 still on iTunes. And so that film really kind of got out there and made a lot of noise. And so, you know, far more than I thought it would. And that kind of led to my next documentary, Money Machine.
It's so awesome that, you know, not that that happened to you, but that you took action and made a response instead of just like, you know, letting it just kind of like be swept under the rug to make a full on statement with the situation that you had. I'm sure a lot of people could relate to that. It's such a timely documentary right now.
Yeah. You know, and it was, when it happened, I originally tried to pursue like a lawsuit. And then when I found out that they claimed that the video, you know, that the video cameras weren't on that night, they said it was a Sunday night and they made up this crap, you know, because the area where this happened would have been held liable. So the video conveniently went disappearing and stuff. So I had a lawyer at one time and stuff, but I just hated how slow that whole process moves. And I just, you know, and so I just kind of said, you know what, I'm not doing this. I'm going to start doing something more proactive. And so instead of, you know, because I started talking to people about lawsuits and stuff, and the reality is they drag on for 4 or 5 years. And unless you get killed by the police or whatever, it's not, you're not talking about a big bunch of, it just wasn't something that I didn't feel good when I was pursuing that. I felt like things were moving slow, and that, and you know, I didn't feel good again until I started actually doing something about it, making a film about it, and kind of examining these other stories of corruption. So, you know, it really kind of like started my life going in a different direction, that incident, you know, because I really never was a police accountability activist until that happened. And you know, and that was really what taught me that it's a real thing. I mean, police corruption is a very real thing. There are officers in this country who lie, beat people up, and make videos disappear. It's a real thing. You know, there's corrupt officers out there, and they tend to travel in packs. And so they tend to cover for each other. And anyway, since that incident, I've been pretty seriously devoted to that cause, just because I – you know, when it happens to you, you see that it's real. When it happens 4 feet in front of your face, then you watch the officers lie and get away with it. You know, so the kind of this uprising that's happening in America right now, you know, I've been kind of hammering away on this stuff for the last 5 or 6 years, and it's nice to see other people kind of joining the party a little bit. Not that it's a party. I mean, it's been a pretty grim last couple of weeks in America.
Well, it sounds like you were a big catalyst, though, you know, like, because it's just showing the information. You're like giving an eyeglass to the situation in a way that people just need to see it. You know, it's like you're giving that perspective.
And see, I think that's what was unusual about my situation, is that I think a lot of people who are abused by police, they don't really have the tools to fight back because they don't know how to use the media. You know, when you take on large corporations or large government organizations, you can't ever beat them really in court. You can't beat that. Like, about the only way you can really beat them is by exposing corruption with video and media. So I think I gave the LVMPD a lot more than they expected, more than they could really handle, which is good. I mean, you know, they did what they did, and they deserve the repercussions that came from it. But, you know, and the other thing I like to do is help other people who've been abused by, like, help get their stories out through media as well. Because that's really the only way to fight back against powerful organizations, in my opinion, you know, is just a regular person, you know?
Did you ever send them a copy or let them know that you finished this project about them, or no?
Oh, they know all about it. I mean, you know, back in 2017, it was playing at all the, you know, the festivals in Vegas, won the awards, and, you know, it would, but here was the interesting thing. We had 3 different theaters in Vegas book the film and then pull out. And one of those theaters was called and Fox 5 in Vegas even did a story about it, that this theater, The Eclipse, had booked the film. You know, and I had evidence of all this, you know, from email and stuff, and then backed out. So it was, you know, so they're very aware of the movie, to say the least.
That's when you know you're making an impact, when you start getting some of those obstacles, unfortunately. It's like, you know, the powers that be are, you're shaking their tree a little bit, you know?
Well, the way I feel about it is they deserve that. You know, when you sign on to, you know, to supposedly protect the public that you're supposed to serve, and you abuse that authority by lying, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you deserve to absolutely be smashed in the face with the truth. And so I don't apologize. You know, like I've always said, I'm not asking you guys to like it. No one's interested in your opinion of the movie. You know, no one's going, oh, what do you think, LVMPD? No, you did what you did. You know, you guys have lied, abused your authority, and now you get to pay the price for it. You know, no one's asking you to like it, you know?
Well, the cool thing, too, it's you've now done this second movie, Money Machine, and it also takes place in Vegas. So you're like, you're taking on a very kind of, you know, it's one of the closest police states we have. And I like that you're just shaking things up. Tell us a little about Money Machine. I know this is about the biggest massacre in U.S. history, but tell me what about it, you know, just made you, that inspired you to make another film about it.
So, interestingly, October 2017 happened right around the time that my previous film, What Happened in Vegas, was kind of going through Vegas. And one of the things that was very surprising to me was that retired officers in the LVMPD started reaching out to me to actually say, hey, thank you for exposing this corruption. You know, we have a really bad sheriff in there right now, a very corrupt sheriff, and we don't like what's going on in the department. And so I kind of came to realize that there's actually good officers in this department who don't like what's going on. And these people, interestingly, kind of became my allies. And so right after 1 October happened, they were the ones who was telling me what was really going on with the Vegas mass shooting, not what Sheriff Joe Lombardo was claiming was going on. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm talking about retired, there's about four or five retired sergeants and lieutenants who I was regularly in contact with, and they were getting the information directly from their sources in the department. And I found that it checked out every time. Like, for example, there was an accidental discharge in Stephen Paddock's room on the night of 1 October, and the sheriff didn't say one thing about it. He tried to cover it up, tried to hide it. And there was also an officer who was, you know, who could have stopped the shooting and was just sitting there cowering in the hallway while this guy's killing people. So, you know, it's possible that fewer people could have died. But so basically what happened was 1 October became this massive international media event. The stage was huge, and the truth is that the LVMPD was wildly incompetent that night. They screwed a lot of things up, and MGM was also, you know, security failure in allowing this guy to bring over 20 guns, and so there was really kind of a cover up of incompetence, and that's what Money Machine exposes, and it shows how this happened and how MGM used their massive resources and power to cover up the truth, and how the LVMPD helped them. So, and for selfish reasons, because not a lot of people realize that the sheriff, Joe Lombardo, actually had an election coming up that year. And all of a sudden, he's on an international stage, so he couldn't be exposed. So these things couldn't come out. You know, it couldn't come out that you had an officer shaking in the hallway like a little baby, you know? But then what happened was after things died down, they fired this guy, Cordell Hendricks. And then, so there's just many things like this that they tried to hide and cover up. And so our documentary really gets to the truth of what was really happening on 1 October. And it's straight from the people in the department that gave me this information.
And one of the things you said, the shooter, Steven, he gambled $1.6 million and lost. And so his vendetta was against the casino gaming industry?
Yes. Now, we're not exactly, I want to clarify, the $1.6 million that he gambled, that's what they call handle in Vegas, meaning like that's the total amount of money that like went through the machines. It's kind of unclear. That's from the accountant. It's kind of unclear how much of that was lost or won or whatever. But basically what had happened was over a long period of time, Stephen Paddock had gotten very disillusioned with MGM and basically wanted to do something that would permanently hurt them. And he did. I mean, let's face it, like nobody wants to acknowledge that. But the truth is he did hurt Vegas, and he did show the world how bad security is in Vegas. You know, so there's a lot of things that drove him to that, but a lot of it was, you know, and MGM's really kind of hid their culpability in helping drive Stephen Paddock to that, because obviously the public would be outraged if you know, it comes out that 58 people died, you know, and all these people were injured because of what MGM did to Paddock. And I don't want to make Paddock sound like a victim. He's not a victim. What he did was atrocious. It was terrible. There's no justification for it. But our movie makes it clear that there's more than one villain in this case. Certainly Stephen Paddock's a villain, but so is MGM. And when you really start digging into what they did and what they did to the victims of this shooting when they tried to sue them, and I mean, they've just behaved disgracefully at every turn, and they've used their power and resources to hide that from the public.
That is crazy. So tell me, and you know, one of the things that I saw on the trailer was, you know, they raised a bunch of money with the hashtag Vegas Strong, and the, how the money dispersed was one of the things that a lot of people don't know about. That I was actually shocked watching that part. Like, how did you find out how the money was actually dispersed and how much they raised?
So here's the thing. So Vegas is a very image conscious town. And so when this happened, when 1 October happened, they immediately had Vegas Strong ready to go. You know, it's kind of amazing. It's like the next morning they got Vegas Strong signs up and we're Vegas Strong and all this stuff. And what was unfortunate about that was that in the first 5 months, so this, it ultimately raised over $10 million. But in the first 5 months, less than 20,000 of those Vegas Strong funds actually was distributed. And now eventually a lot of the money did get distributed. But here's the problem. These people needed that money now. They were injured. I mean, you know, their car payments were due. Their house payments are due. You know, they can't work. They were injured. They were traumatized. So, you know, getting the money 2 years later doesn't really help them, you know, when you've already been evicted from your house and can't pay your car, you know, and these things. So it really kind of showed the whole thing with Vegas Strong is it was also an opportunity for the politicians to grandstand, to jump in front of the cameras and make it look like they cared so much about these victims. And what they really cared about was themselves. And one politician in particular, Steve Sisolak, actually used Vegas Strong to become the next governor of Nevada. But when you really start diving in there and seeing how the funds were distributed and how long they took to be, it becomes pretty clear that Vegas Strong was never really about the victims. It was about, you know, Steve Sisolak jumping in front of international cameras and making it look like he was some humanitarian who cared so that he could become governor. And there were other politicians who joined in that little who did that as well. It was just a grandstanding event that politicians took advantage of. And it's sad because, you know, when you talk to the actual survivors, what these people have been through is unbelievable. I mean, and not just the people who've died, but there've been suicides. There's a lot of suicides involved in this. You never hear about this stuff. You know, people who, as a result of 1 October, and I mean, if you talk to anybody who was there that night, it usually doesn't take them too long to start welling up with tears and stuff. I mean, it was just a tremendously awful thing that happened. And I kind of understood it and sympathized with it because when the Twin Towers went down on 9/11, my brother was working in New York City that time. And he was like 3 or 4 blocks working away when that happened, and he watched people, you know, jump to their deaths and, you know, out of this burning building, and just, he had a hell of a time with it. My brother was deeply traumatized by that. And he's a very tough, stoic kind of guy. And so I kind of understood, you know, making the film, I felt like I had that in common with a lot of the victims. I could really understand how much they were going through because I saw it with my brothers. One of the toughest guys I know, but I don't think anything's quite ever hit him like that hit him.
Well, I mean, it's such a traumatic thing to see death or to be even around it. And all those people that were there, including the 9/11 victims, it's like it's a world tragedy in one single, maybe 20-minute moment, 15-minute moment. And with the Vegas situation, you know, it was very strange what you said, how he got so many guns through the hotels. And there were rumors, I don't know if you uncovered this in your movie, that he and his girlfriend went out to the concert grounds like the day before, or 2 days before, and she was like warning people like not to be in the area because she had a bad feeling something would go down. Did you?
I don't know about that. I've never been able to substantiate that. I've heard other people say that, but I don't really know if that's true or not, to be honest.
So what was the craziest thing that you discovered about the actual crime as it was happening?
I think one of the craziest things is that you had a freaking officer firing a gun in Stephen Paddock's room on that night, and that they didn't, and that the sheriff hid that from the public. I mean, that's unbelievable. And why did he hide it? He hid it because it makes his department look like a bunch of boobs. It makes them look incompetent. And sadly, that's...
I mean, they were shooting into the room and missing?
Okay, so they did a breach on the door. And when they, you know, knocked open that door, one of the guns discharged. Or that's what they claim happened. I mean, that's a pretty big event. And Bombardo hid that. But here's the other interesting thing. So the 1 October footage, those phone calls from that night, all that stuff, that's public information. So the public's supposed to have access to that. Joe Lombardo, because he had an election coming up, he obstructed that information. Like, he was ordered to release it, and media organizations even sued. Like, 6 or 7 large media organizations, like the LA Times, got together. I think New York Times is on that list. And they sued the LVMPD to release those documents. And Joe Lombardo used public tax dollars' money to hire attorneys to fight them releasing this footage. And why did he do that? He did it because he had an election coming up. And he couldn't have that footage coming out showing what cowards his officers were, and that accidental discharge, you know, because that footage had, you know, it had footage of Cordell Hendricks, the LVMPD officer, shaking outside in the hallway like a little baby, you know, and like, ooh, you know, instead of like going in there. And so I thought that was pretty incredible that, and by delaying the footage and using, you know, his lawyers, his like, and to do that, what happened was, it was until, you know, Lombardo got elected, and then that stuff came out. So I thought that was pretty sneaky, and shows you a lot about who that guy really is, and what they really cared about.
And what was some of the inner workings of the Las Vegas Police Department, and how they were working with MGM that was super corrupt? Kind of unravel a little bit of that.
Well, interestingly, after this happened, they were talking about donating that land, the Route 91 land. MGM was talking about donating that land to the LVMPD so they could build a SWAT headquarters on it. Okay, so that, I mean, so you're going to have like bullets whizzing around this memorial where 58 people died. You're going to have, you know, and it's right by the Vegas Strip, and you're going to have guns getting fired. I mean, it's just, what a bunch of morons, frankly. Right. I mean, what else do you call that? I mean, it's like the worst idea everyone's ever heard. And this actually hit the public news for a couple of days that MGM was considering, you know, giving this land to the LVMPD so they could build SWAT headquarters. And then that obviously didn't go over well with the public, so they yanked that idea. But it's just kind of incredible how crass MGM's treatment of the victims was. And then you saw it later when they actually sued the victims of 1 October, which was, you couldn't have made that up. Do you recall that event?
No. So tell me more about that.
So it's part of some elaborate legal maneuver. MGM knew they were going to get sued by several thousand people. So what they did in anticipation with that is that they sued them first, and then they I forget the exact but basically what that allows them to do is kind of consolidate things into one lawsuit. There's something called the Safety Act that was put in place after 9/11, and they were trying to like hang their hat on the Safety Act, like that this was and so basically what the Safety Act says is that if you have security at an event that's been certified by the Department of Homeland Security, that then you're not liable for the terrorist event. So they were trying to, MGM kind of tried to use the Safety Act to get off the hook for this lawsuit, and that didn't work. And so when it didn't work, they ended up settling with the victims for like around $800 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but you're talking about like 4,000 plus people are part of that lawsuit. And you're also talking about lawyers who are taking 30 to 40% of that. So it's really not a lot of money at all. And you know, and again, this was just kind of a yet another, and get this, insurance, MGM's insurance was actually covering 750 of that $800 million. So, you know, you have an event where 58 people died, hundreds were injured because of MGM's negligence, and they get off the hook with only paying around $50 million. So, which is basically a slap on the wrist. It's like if you or I walked out of the room and dropped a quarter or something. So they really, you know, they won. You know, MGM definitely won, and so did the lawyers who were walking away with a bunch of cash. But I think the victims in this case really lost, and that's what our documentary Money Machine kind of it really dives into all this and goes beyond the PR stuff that MGM fed the public and kind of takes a probing look into the reality of things. And
you finished first.
Yeah, and then it also just shows how Vegas is a town that's been ruined by greed, and how this is kind of the perfect example of that. How corporate greed has ruined Vegas, and how Vegas was actually might have been a better town when it was run by mobsters and gangsters. You know,
right? You know, I think you said the Vegas Strong, organization raised something like $11 million. But do you know, like, a firm figure as to how much was pocketed or dispersed amongst the organization?
You know what? I haven't. I've been trying to get that information. See, the thing was, Steve Sisolak, who was in charge of Vegas Room, he said he was originally going to make all that information public, and he has not. So my understanding of it at this point is that a lot of the funds have been distributed, but a lot of it was distributed really late in the game, well over a year after it happened. And remember, when a disaster happens, people need those funds now, you know? And so that's the one thing in the film, you know, we haven't been able to see, we can't really get our hands on that until he releases that information. So, I definitely talked to some people, one October survivors who've gotten some of the money, and but it's, for whatever reason, he's been very kind of hush-hush about it and hasn't honored what he said he was going to do, which is make all that information public and transparent.
Did he get elected governor?
He did. He got elected governor, and a lot of people would tell you it was all that FaceTime that he got from, Vegas Strong. And he knew a good opportunity when he saw one, and sadly it worked.
That is crazy. What was one of the biggest obstacles you had while shooting Money Machine?
One of the biggest obstacles is because of what happened in Vegas, they knew who I was, very much so. And also, you know, I'm 6'4". I'm a big guy. Like, it's hard for me to be real, to move around real discreetly in Vegas and not be seen. And then the other thing you'll notice about Vegas is you'll notice you never really see paparazzi in Vegas. You never really see paparazzi shots. They don't like cameras. Like when if you have like a big or what looks like a professional camera on the Vegas Strip, they'll shut you down real fast. So one of the big challenges I ran into is I had to, it's kind of funny to say this, but I would actually go out of my way to look like a tourist, you know, and I would hide my appearance a great deal. And I would just try to look like I was like, you know, Bob from Cleveland, you know, I'd wear like a Cleveland Indians hat dress, you know, I'd wear like something that made it look like I was a tourist, and I'd, you know, sunglasses and stuff. And so, and then I also had to get cameras that looked like they were amateur cameras, but actually delivered like pro quality video. So that was very important. It's a lot of it's appearance. Like if you bring in a camera that's big, that looks like a professional camera, you'll get kicked out real fast. But so to answer your question, a lot of my my obstacle was just like, you know, trying to disguise who I was and make it look like I wasn't doing what I really was doing. What I was really doing was shooting a professional quality film, but posing as an amateur dude from Cleveland or Chicago or Iowa to do so.
What was one of the most shocking things you discovered about the shooter?
I would say, you know, we interviewed his brother, Eric Paddock, and And so Eric Paddock, you know, we have an exclusive interview with him in Money Machine, and the interview is absolutely riveting. Because one of the things I didn't realize about Steve was that he was not a guy who ever raised his voice. He wasn't a yeller. He wasn't a screamer. He was very generally calm. I mean, he had not had any previous brushes with law enforcement. There just really was very little in his background to indicate that this would happen. So I would say that was the shocking part. And even, you know, we learned a great deal about Stephen Paddock by talking to his brother. And when we also learned that a lot of the ideas that were put out there by the public were about Stephen Paddock were not true. Like the idea that he was there in Vegas to, like, that he was a professional gambler there to make money and stuff. That's not really true. Stephen Paddock actually made a lot of his money in real estate. You know, he had been a millionaire. But basically what what his brother made it clear to us was that Stephen Paddock, you know, he was retired. Basically his goal was to just break even on the casino. You know, if he broke even gambling, and he felt like he was coming out ahead on the, you know, with the comps, you know, the free hotel stays and the shrimp cocktails and the show tickets. So that, you know, you heard a lot of stuff about Stephen Paddock was this high roller professional gambler, and he did throw a lot of money around, but he wasn't really there to take a lot of money out of the casino. It was mostly just the lifestyle that he liked. You know, it was something interesting to do, and it was, you know, but what kept happening was that Stephen Paddock was a good gambler, and actually before he came to Vegas, he was living in Reno, and they figured out real quick that they weren't necessarily making money off this guy. You know, and like the Atlantis is a pretty fancy casino in Reno. And Stephen Paddock was kind of there before he came to Vegas. And I mean, he was such a high roller that they rented out like an entire floor on the Atlantis casino for Paddock's family at one point. But then it wasn't too long after that where they just started kind of cutting off his comps. And that's kind of the same thing that happened to him in Vegas. And that's kind of why he left Reno and ended up going towards Vegas. You know, he had a home in Mesquite. And but what was going on is it's like, you know, these casino hosts, this was another really interesting thing we learned. These casino hosts, you know, as long as you're losing money, they'll treat you like royalty, you know, right. Just they'll kick your butt and fly jets out for you and this and that. But when you actually show that you're good at this and that you can actually go out of that casino and not lose money and you know, then they start doing things to discourage you and they start taking things away. And that was, and MGM has kind of hidden the fact that that was really what was going on with Paddock too. For a long period of time, they started taking things away, pulling his comps, and that was one of the reasons, things that drove him to do this. And MGM's done a good job of trying to hide that from the public.
Wow. I never would have put those two things together. I just thought he was a gambler and wanted to make a statement because he was struck. So in a lot of ways, this was a statement against MGM, not so much like to make the news or whatever, right?
Yes, he wanted to do, I mean, if you think about it, like think about a casino and how big and powerful they are. What could you do to really hurt a casino? Write a Yelp review? Who cares?
Right.
Like, you know, you write a Yelp review. I don't like Mandalay Bay. They cut off my, I mean, that's not going to have any impact. So a lot of people, would, you know, his brother would tell you he wanted to do something that would make an impact. And
did his brother know about it before or no?
No. In fact, his brother, you know, Eric Paddock has a couple of kids and he told me, he says, listen, if I would have known he was going to do this, I would have notified somebody because I, you know, he's like, I don't think Eric says he never gave his brother a pass for what he did. He thinks what his brother did was atrocious. That said, I mean, Eric Paddock has tried to do a lot of things to kind of like help in any way he can. Like, for example, he sold Steven's assets and gave the money to charity. So, you know, Eric Paddock, a lot of people have kind of like given him a lot of flack for the interviews he did and stuff, but the truth is that he, actually tried to do the right thing and has donated a lot of that money. And he doesn't at all endorse what his brother did. There's nothing right about what Paddock did.
Right.
But there are reasons that he did it. And that's what MGM's tried to hide, is that they're part of the reason he did this.
That's intense. I never would have thought that would have been part of it. Hey, Renan, let's play the trailer. Renan, are you there? I think we're going to play the trailer real quick.
Sure.
All right, here it comes.
We're talking about the largest mass shooting in the history of the United States.
This is a crazed lunatic.
My brother just killed 58 people. My dad was on the 10 most wanted FBI list. We're not normal people. Steve gambled $1.6 million at the Mandalay in the week before he did this. He was really, really angry with the gaming industry.
There's been accusations that there's multiple shooters. That has been proven to be false.
You had politicians grandstanding on this Vegas Strong movement to get elected.
Vegas Strong.
I'm turning tragedy into opportunity.
It was an election year, and it was camera time for Lombardo and his friends.
I want to thank Sheriff Lombardo for your leadership.
I'm getting faced up every day.
Almost every press conference, you saw one figure, and that was Steve Sisolak, using this as a springboard for his political campaign.
He used the tragedy to get elected.
While the hashtag Vegas Strong campaign raised over $10 million, less than $20,000 were distributed to the victims in the first 5 months.
We want those records released!
If they came out and said what really happened, I think they're afraid of a period of time where people say it's not safe to go to Vegas.
Nothing happens in Las Vegas without the ring of a cash register.
MGM Resorts is suing the victims.
They are being sued for getting shot.
Shameful, disgusting, outrageous.
The newly released video shows Las Vegas police waiting in the hallway as Stephen Paddock continues to murder people.
Lives could have been saved if they would have taken action.
They were fibbing the whole time about being such big heroes. They're hiding in the hallway.
I asked them, are you stupid or are you incompetent?
Please stop asking your question.
You hear officers directly saying, turn your cameras off.
I'm telling you right now, there's more than one shooter. Could be as many as three.
We saw multiple muzzle flashes coming out that window.
There is no conspiracy.
Can't trust it! Yeah, can't trust this!
Wow. That is some crazy, crazy, crazy stuff.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, it's amazing that you put all this together. What made you kind of go down the rabbit hole to make this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really, you know, making my first film, What Happened in Vegas, I kind of really saw, I learned a lot about Vegas that wasn't necessarily in that film. I learned about power and money and greed and how Vegas is run and how they use their influence to kind of like suppress things in the media that aren't good for business. And so I think it was that. It was really, and combined with the fact that what I was being told by, you know, retired officers who were in the department, it was just absolutely fascinating that what was being presented to the public as happening on 1 October was such a far cry from what was really happening. And to hear that information straight from the people in the know, the retired officers who were talking to the people still working in the department. So again, it was like, you know, let me backtrack a little bit. I remember the very first time I ever went to Vegas was in 2014. And I remember 2004, I'm sorry. Okay. In 2004, you know, right when I first came to LA, you know, when I remember riding into Vegas and seeing, like, you know, I pulled over to get a cup of coffee and I remember there was this girl who looked like she'd just been thrown out of the house or something. She was just kind of crying. Her mascara was smudged. She's like outside the 7-Eleven with just kind of bawling. And I never really forgot that image. That was the first thing I ever saw in Las Vegas. And that image has never really left me of, you know, kind of the sharp contrast between, you know, the gloss on the surface and the and what's going on underneath and the darkness underneath. And I think, you know, so as I was riding into Vegas that first time, I saw all the bright lights and stuff. And then, but then I also saw a hint of that darkness. And so I think I've been just, I think I'm riveted by the stark contrast of what Vegas really is and what it presents itself as. I think it's kind of, it's almost like it's not even America, quite right. frankly. Like
well, Vegas, you know what? The thing is, I feel like it, you know, and I, this is just my opinion. Like I've been working in the music industry for, I mean, decades, and the music industry is a lot like Vegas. Vegas is a lot like the government. I feel like this is how capitalism works. When there's a lot of money prevalent or anticipated by several different parties, they're the ones pulling the strings. We're just like watching the puppet show, you know? So the weird thing is, I feel like the illusion is that capitalism is this beneficial thing for every social class, but it's really benefiting the one percenters. And what I love about your film and the fact that you're making movies like this, you're exposing these puppeteers, you know, that you're showing the corruption. And that's what more people need to see, because, you know, the one thing that we do have is the right to vote. The one thing that we do have the right to do is to protest. The one thing that we do have is we can make art that is, you know, that, you know, elicits change or.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's so awesome that, you know, you're starting to see all these things. And I think, you know, Michael Moore, I think he did that for me too. I think he kind of showed me that that's how capitalism works. It's like, when it doesn't surprise me that casinos work the way they do when our government works the same way. And then you see, you know, like one small division is the music industry. And it's like, when I look at radio charts or when I look at album sales, when you start to find all the weird politics as to how things are conveyed or put together so that they know how the reaction will be, I mean, it just gets into a really dark ring of circles that, you know, that, you know, it's all made, it's all fake, it's all contrived, because there's money to be made and there's marketing dollars at stake and there's profits, you know, and that is king, which is really what your movie is saying. And that's what I love. It's like, it shows a little bit of politics. It shows a little bit about some, you know, conspiracy theory. It shows some crime scene, you know, footage. And it also intertwines it all with a narrative that is saying, open your eyes to the American public, to the global public.
Well, you know, and I just want to say that one of the wonderful things about our country is the freedom of press that we have in this country. I mean, I honestly believe if I'd made films like this, exposing corruption in some countries, they would just show up at my door and whack off my head.
Right. You
know? Like, I mean, I do think what you're saying is right. Like, you know, we're able to make art that kind of exposes this corruption. And you know, I don't take that for granted. I mean, I think, you know, when the forefathers wrote that Constitution, they had a lot of good stuff there. And I think that the freedom of press that we have in this country. And, you know, I think Michael Moore is really the first guy who just did that on a beautiful scale, like with Roger and Me. I mean, what a great film that was. And here was this guy from Flint, Michigan, who never made more than $30,000 in a year, who made this movie that just knocked GM on their butt and basically exposed them as liars, you know. And I mean, it was just, you know, the power of that, you know. And so, I mean, people can criticize Michael Moore all they want, but I mean, this is a guy who did something really beautiful, and he's done it many times since.
You know what? I never miss one of his documentaries, because I think he is a really powerful voice, and a lot of people like to write him off because he's speaking so much of the truth that, you know, it's easy for people to say, oh, this is a one-sided argument. This is, you know, so I think he's figuring out a way to kind of like get closer to the middle so that he can attract more of that the conflicting voices and that audience to kind of raise eyebrows, because I think that's what the power of a documentary is. It's like it's showing you something that you're not aware of, and it may differ from the opinion that you may have. And that if you can change the minds of people with a film or a song or a, you know, a poem or whatever it is, that's why we make art. You know, it's like a different scale of you know, art. As soon as I read, you know, what this movie was about, I was so excited to do this interview because, man, you and I are like eye to eye on how we see things. And the crazy thing is what you're exposing is really delicate stuff. Like, it's stuff that people don't want out. And it takes an incredible amount of courage to make a film like this. And I have to ask you, did you ever feel like any part of your life was in danger while making this movie?
Yeah. yes. Gosh. You know, there was an incident. I was over by like Circus filming. And, you know, and I saw an LVMPD police car drive by. I was like filming this TV station. And I saw, you know, a car drive by. And I kind of, it just looked weird to me. And so I started like walking away. And then I noticed, and I went around the corner, and I got away from it, and I looked back, and I noticed that there was like two LVMPD cars just kind of waiting around the corner from where my car was. And for a while. So what I did is I went into a casino and just like hung out for like a half hour and came, and I peered around the corner, and like I could see just barely these two cars just kind of hovering there. And I didn't know what to do. So I started just live streaming. And, you know, like with the idea that if anything happens to me, you know, and I was live streaming, and I went, got my car and drove out of there. And, but yeah, there's incidents like that.
Crazy.
You know, and also just, of course, you get the social media stuff occasionally, you know, the anonymous person, you know, the creepy profile. I got a message from a guy like a couple weeks ago, you know, like his profile picture was like a gun next to a bunch of cash, you know, like that's all it was. Like, there's no picture of the guy. It was just a gun next to cash, you know, like basically I got the idea, like, you know, and this guy's sending me a friend request. It's like, you know, like the weird message to me, and I could be wrong about this, was, you know, a hitman, like, you know, I mean, things like that happen. And it's, you know, it can be scary, but, you know, I do think that, you know, if your time on Earth comes to an end, if you've at least done things to shine a light on the corruption and gotten that message out there, then, you know, you go when you go. And I mean, that doesn't mean it's not scary sometimes, but I refuse to like live. I feel like what I'm doing is the truth. And I'm fortunate that I've gotten a lot of support for it. So, you know, I'm not going to be stopped from doing it. But, you know, I'm human just like anybody else. I don't love getting that. I don't love any of this stuff, you know.
Well, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's you know, there's so many movies. There's a movie, like, you know, Hurricane. I'm sure you've seen that movie. And it's like, as they're trying to expose the truth, they're actually exposing, you know, the you know, false oversights of the police departments, and it's plural. And it's like all of these all these things are getting us closer to what is the truth. And I applaud you for making a movie like this, because A, it's not easy. B, it's tremendous, because it's like earth shaking, you know, and I hope you continue to make movies. One more time, where can people find your movie, and when will it be released?
Yeah. If you go to Money Machine on Facebook, I think there's a link to our page on your show's page. Money Machine's been fortunate enough to get a theatrical release. So starting July 3rd, the movie's going to be playing at Lemley Theaters and some other theaters as well. And then, you know, depending on the COVID situation, there might be some, there's other theaters as well that if they're unable to open by that time, will be playing the movie by, you know, through streaming. So there's that at home. Cinema at Home is the platform that they're going to be using in case. So I think it's going to be kind of a hybrid mixture of both. Theatrical at Home is the name of the service we're using. That, you know, if some of these theaters are unable to open by that time, people will be able to watch it at home through streaming.
Are you doing an LA release?
Yeah, we're doing an LA. I mean, we've got other, you know, all over the country. We've got different, you know, like a small theatrical release, but it's, you know, we've got theaters all over the country, but especially here in like California and LA, we have a lot of, like Lemley's theaters are showing the film. That Showtime.
Well, I was just wondering if there was a Q&A that people could attend if they wanted to. Are you doing any Q&A?
You know, we're wanting to set up a big, you know, our premiere at, you know, opening night at Lemley Theaters. And of course, one of the things I'm waiting for is to actually make sure that happens, you know, because of this COVID situation has really kind of just thrown everything, into chaos and disarray. So yeah, the plan is to, have theaters open on July 3rd and hopefully that happens. And if it does, we'll definitely have our big premiere at Lemley Theaters here in LA.
Well, Ramsey, you are a tremendous individual. You've made a tremendous film, and I hope it has a tremendous reaction amongst the public, because this is the kind of truth that we need in the world. So thank you for making this movie. Thank you for doing what you're doing, uncovering the truth. And we're going to have you back for your next projects, man.
I'd love to.
No, anytime you got something to show,
talking to you and, a similar mentality. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being on, man. And anytime you got any upcoming showcases of any of your films, you let me know, man. I'd love to have you on board again, okay?
All right. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Take care, man. Be good. Have a good night.